It is Monday, February 8th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Just ahead, we'll catch up with our national correspondent in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire, where voters will soon take part in the first primary of the U.S. presidential election season. VOA's financial markets reporter will be here to tell us why investors are so worried about the health of major global banks. A disillusioned Syrian rebel fighter speaks to us about his sense of betrayal by the West, and will tell you what books are selling fast on the streets of Africa's biggest city. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, the final political surveys ahead of New Hampshire's primary election on Tuesday show billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump continuing to hold a substantial lead in the first U.S. Republican presidential primary election. Earlier, I spoke to our national correspondent Jim Malone in the city of Manchester, New Hampshire, and I asked him what Trump and the other leading contenders have been up to on the final day of campaigning.
Well, it's a furious last-minute push for votes here in New Hampshire. You have numerous rallies by all the major contenders across the southern part of the state primarily. They're not only trying to hit crowds of people and larger rallies, but they're also trying to hit local and national television coverage to try to make their appeals to voters in the final hours here. You know, New Hampshire voters are notorious for taking their time in consideration of candidates. And after all, some of these candidates have been up here campaigning in New Hampshire, the site of the first primary, for maybe a year and a half.
Well, which candidates have been doing more of that kind of campaigning than others?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the Republican side, according to the latest polls, and it's been fairly consistent, Donald Trump is the leader. Now, could he be upset? It's possible, but most people here think there's a huge scrum of candidates fighting to be number two behind Trump. And the people in that boat would include Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, who won the Iowa caucuses. And we also have several governors who are vying for viability. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, as well as Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and Ohio Governor John Kasich. All of them are vying in New Hampshire because their kind of more moderate Republican appeal suits New Hampshire voters better. The problem is there's too many choices for New Hampshire voters, and it's possible we won't have a great deal of clarity come Wednesday morning about those four or five contenders. They all could be fairly bunched together.
Now, we've only got two contenders on the Democratic side, and the polls have shown that Senator Bernie Sanders has held on to a big lead over former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Given Secretary Clinton's superior resources, why isn't she doing better in the polling leading up to this vote?
I'm sure a lot of people around the world would like to know the answer to that question. I can tell you here, Sanders does have a lead. It's fairly consistent, though. Some of the polling, as we get closer to the vote, shows that Clinton is making perhaps a bit of headway. But we have noticed that the tone of the campaign between the two of them has gotten kind of negative and in some cases nasty. And one of the contributors is Hillary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, who's been trying to call out the folks who support Bernie Sanders, saying basically that they're unrealistic in sort of supporting the kind of revolutionary ideals that Sanders talks about. But he's got a very strong following here, especially among younger people. And it's a struggle for Clinton right now in terms of getting out the voters that she wants to reach.
Well, what do you think will be Secretary Clinton's next move? I think it's fair to say that a loss in New Hampshire isn't the end for her, right?
Not at all. In fact, the Clinton firewall, if you will, in their campaign really goes south. And the reason for that is this. Once you get to the South Carolina primary coming up later in the month, you get the real first impact of African-American, of minority voters, and this is a real strength for the Clinton campaign. It's an area where Sanders has tried to improve his showing, but so far has had limited success. Clinton can count on a lot of support from African Americans. And also in the case of the Nevada caucuses coming up, she hopes to count on support from Latino Americans. So the Clinton firewall really has to do with that large group of minority voters in the Democratic Party. And they are confident once the race goes south from New Hampshire and west, that they're going to be in a better position. But you know what, Michael? Right now, all signs point to this Democratic race going on for quite a while. And given the tone of late, I'd pay attention to it. It could get even nastier.
Something to definitely to watch out for. Thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, in New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for a check of social media, and our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is with me in the studio now to tell us what the leading U.S. presidential candidates are tweeting about. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So who do you want to talk to us about first today?
Sure. I mean, we love to begin with Donald Trump, but for a change, let's begin with the Democratic Party.
Sounds good.
Hillary Clinton runs, as you know, a very prolific and savvy Twitter campaign, and she has been sharing her day with her Twitter followers like other contenders, but this is what she's doing differently. She got her husband, who we all know as former President Bill Clinton, involved.
And how exactly is he involved?
Through Instagram. So Bill Clinton tweeted, "I am taking over Hillary's Instagram from New Hampshire today. Follow along." And then he added a link to her Instagram page. The pictures were shared on Twitter, but what's interesting is that Bill Clinton himself is in it. So naturally, people are asking, so who took the photo then?
Probably not Bill, right?
No, I'm guessing the staffers. Other comments were less friendly, suggesting Bill Clinton's past infidelity. For example, one person wrote, "Be careful what you take pictures of." But Clinton still won some brownie points from Asian American voters by wishing everyone a happy Lunar New Year. Bernie Sanders, for his part, didn't do that.
Well, what did Sanders say?
Well, to come out and vote, basically. He posted a video of himself speaking in the snow, saying, "If there's a high turnout tomorrow, I think we're going to win. I urge you all, come out and vote."
If they can get through the snow. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also been quite a negative back and forth between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush. What's going on there?
Oh, absolutely. It all started out with Trump tweeting this. "Jeb Bush has zero communication skills, so he spent a fortune of special interest money on a Super Bowl ad. He is a weak candidate." Bush replied, "Donald Trump, you aren't just a loser. You're a liar and a whiner. John McCain is a hero, over and out." And Trump sent out at least three tweets about Bush after that. That's all for me today.
Well, thanks so much, G. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, she is at G Abby Lee. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
There may be gold atop the minaret, but a new mosque being built in Massy, France, is definitely green. Mahmoud Ismail is a member of the Muslim Committee of Massy.
"We thought that in Islam, ecological principles have existed since the 14th century, and nowadays the world is coming back to this."
Ismail says there are invisible, environmentally friendly elements incorporated into the structure, such as double insulated walls. Then there are more apparent green aspects of the mosque.
"We have the reminder of traditional mosque elements, that's to say the minaret and the dome. But now both have new functions. The minaret is a light well for the entry hall, and the dome, which became a glass dome, brings all the light to the big prayer room."
Ismail says the environmentally friendly mosque cost about 20% more of the total budget. But he says the money will eventually be recovered. Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. U.S. and European stock markets ended the first trading day of the week with some sharp losses. The Dow Jones fell 1%, and London's FTSE 100 lost more than 2%. I spoke a short time ago to our markets reporter Jill Malandrino, and I asked her what's driving the latest declines.
The big reason why markets have had a really tough time this week and over, you know, since the beginning of 2016, yes, it has been due to oil, and we've seen a tremendous decline from the July 2014 highs. But I think when you isolate it to what we've seen over the past couple of weeks, it's not so much about oil, but what's happening in the banking sector. And if you take a look at the S&P 500 relative to the bank index, or if you look at an exchange-traded fund like the XLF, which tracks major financial commercial banks, you can see how they're running more in lockstep with each other. And the reason being here, we saw weak bank earnings in Europe. And there's a big growing disillusionment with central banks' ability to really manage risk. And in fact, this morning, there was some chatter out in the marketplace that Deutsche Bank could potentially be the next Lehman. It's a pretty big statement for traders to be making. Although we're not looking as bad as we did in 2008, right now, you know, Deutsche's derivative exposure is $75 trillion. That's 20 times Germany's GDP. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace right now. To me, this is a bigger concern than oil. We know what we need to do in order to stabilize oil prices. There are a lot of variables and a lot of uncertainties with the financials right now.
What do you think is behind the weakness in some of these major banks, such as Deutsche Bank?
I think what you're looking at right now, credit spreads are widening tremendously, and that is a negative for global banks right now. And what's happening is these sophisticated derivative products, there's a lot of them on the balance sheets right now. And even more so than that, what has happened with central bank monetary policy since 2008, we've had an artificial bid in the market, if you will, meaning asset purchases by the Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, the Bank of England, all the other global central bankers were buying assets or bonds to really prop up the markets while we navigate through this financial crisis. So we had interest rates raised in December in the U.S. That takes out that bid from the market. You have other global bankers devaluing their currencies. So what you're seeing right now is an all-out currency war, if you will, and there's just no stability across any of the fiat currencies, meaning like the U.S. dollar, for example. The euro is what's considered a fiat benchmark currency.
The U.S. Federal Reserve Chief Janet Yellen is going to be speaking this week. Why are investors going to be paying a lot of attention to what she has to say?
Oh, yeah. Global investors will certainly be paying attention. She's appearing before the House Financial Services Committee, 10 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday. In addition to that, we also have Federal Reserve President Williams speaking on the health and economy in LA the same day. So traders and investors are going to be honed in on the language that they're using. When can we possibly get another interest rate hike? Will we get one at all? Will we possibly see another version of quantitative easing? Because global markets are not digesting the uncertainty in the banking system right now.
And that was our financial markets reporter, Jill Malandrino, speaking with me earlier from VOA's New York studios. Rebels in northern Syria have come under an intense week-long bombing campaign by Russian warplanes. The insurgents also have been trying to fend off a coordinated ground offensive by forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. One young rebel fighter spoke to VOA's Jamie Detmer in Turkey near the Syrian border, describing why he and other fighters have withdrawn from the battlefront.
For almost a quarter of his young life, 20-year-old Ahmed has been a fighter. But the fight has gone out of him. After enduring 400 airstrikes in 4 days in the villages of the northern countryside of Aleppo, where a devastating Syrian government offensive has been pressed, he withdrew from the front line along with 100 of his comrades. He says morale has dropped to rock bottom and militia commanders are trying to boost the confidence of the fighters. There is talk of forming a new Aleppo army, uniting the more moderate, less religious-based militias aligned to the Western-backed Free Syrian Army. When the warplanes paused their bombing runs, there were skirmishes with combatants clashing just meters from each other.
The first days, the fight was it's easy. After that, the second days and the third, it's very difficult. We lost a lot of people, a lot of friends, a lot of fighters.
And the fourth day, the Russian warplanes raised everything in a 3-kilometer area. He tells me that on the fourth day, he was at the battlefront, a chain of villages north of the city of Aleppo. There were more than 400 airstrikes. He says the fighters and civilians alike hid in tunnels dug before the offensive and in bomb craters. He said they could feel and hear the percussion of blasts and the heat as well. At one point, he said, they examined themselves quickly to make sure they had not been hit. Everything was being thrown at them, missiles, barrel bombs, sea mines, as well as vacuum and cluster bombs. He said they became expert at distinguishing from the impact what had been fired at them. A short young man with dark eyes and black hair, he hardly has a need to shave yet. He flicks a cigarette nervously as we talk. When I ask him why he left on the fourth day, he goes quiet. There is a long pause. He says that he and about another 100 fighters from the militia Nor al-Dal al-Zinki withdrew, not because of fear, but because they felt they'd been betrayed, let down by everybody who claimed to be the friends of Syria, meaning the US and the West and Gulf countries, as well as their own commanders. He says the commanders of the Free Syrian Army militias and the hardline Islamist brigades, as well as al-Qaeda's affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, should have set their differences aside and unified. Now it may be too late. Jamie Detmer for VOA News in Gaziantep, Turkey.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Nigerian booksellers are importing books from abroad and selling them on the streets of Africa's largest city. What's popular with the readers may surprise you. Here's Chris Stein in Lagos.
Among the piles of books sold on sidewalks in Nigeria's economic capital, Lagos, you can find the memoirs of American presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ben Carson. You can find self-help texts lying next to phrase books of the local Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba languages. It's Ogbono Osiri's business to keep Nigeria's used booksellers supplied. He fills containers with secondhand books from overseas and brings them to merchants in Nigeria.
Some people can stay in my warehouse from morning to night looking for books. They can just make out one day and be spending here searching for books.
At his sidewalk stall in the bustling Lagos Island business district, Solomon Rabio sells everything from John Grisham and Tom Clancy paperbacks to works by Nigerian authors like Chinua Achebe.
The books that sell most, they are all motivational books. You know, the motivational books, people use it for some form of a business plan, some other thing. People buy a lot.
Imported secondhand books compete with those published by local outfits like CSS Bookshops. The publishing house has been in business since 1869. CSS prints, publishes, and sells school textbooks, biographies, and Christian texts. But managing director Dotun Adeboyega says the biggest threat to his business is piracy.
People do not have money, you know, to buy the good books. In fact, most of the people buy pirated books. That is the major problem facing the industry.
Many of these counterfeit books are printed abroad and imported into Nigeria. He called for more action by the government to staunch the flow. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
American singer-songwriter Dan Hicks, known for his popular blend of folk, jazz, and country music, died on Saturday in California after a two-year battle with cancer. He was 74. Here's International Edition's Steve Norman with a look back at Hicks's career.
Hicks was known as the leader of the acoustic band Dan Hicks and his Otlicks, which was a contemporary band of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane in the late 1960s San Francisco psychedelic scene. He never achieved as much mainstream success as others from that era, but he was highly regarded by fellow musicians. At his commercial peak, Dan Hicks recorded several successful albums for Blue Thumb Records, including Where's the Money, Striking It Rich, and Last Train to Hicksville. One of their big hits through that period was Shorty Falls in Love, featuring the Lickettes. That's right, the Lickettes, Marianne Price and Naomi Eisenberg, plus the rest of the Hot Licks, Sid Page on violin, Jaime Leopold on bass, John Gerton on guitar, and Dan Hicks vocals and guitar.
Like the time we climbed the mountain just to see the moon, Fujiyama and the Rockies were learning soon. Then I would give my China some amount of time. As the stars so far it wouldn't stop.
Here what it is lying on the white sands of the Mississippi.
Just to know about you and me.
I remember the trip to Spain was so insane we could hardly watch it fall.
Luckily the rain that day was full. What's your name? Grab ourselves, so the time as we sped around the world to see if we could see. But I saw you and you saw me mostly.
Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks disbanded in 1973, and Hicks went on to work in a range of arenas, performing on movie soundtracks and with other ensembles, including the Acoustic Warriors. But he later said life was best when he and the Hot Licks were making music like Milkshakin' Mama.
Well, I went down on the street, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And I was real hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw a malt shop. Yeah.
And our thanks to Steve Norman for that report. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Zina Abdulrahman. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Let us know what you think of the show. You can send me a tweet at Michael_Lippin. Of course, you can find our show on Twitter as well. It is at VOA_IE. Have a great week.
And now it's ice cream for her. She asked me,
can I help you? Yeah. What flavor would you like?
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, recently contributed $20 million to support the provision of food to approximately 1.2 million temporarily displaced persons of the federally administered tribal areas. 75,000 earthquake-affected individuals and 153,500 malnourished women and children in Pakistan. This new contribution by the United States will be managed by the United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, which will mill approximately 40,000 metric tons of wheat provided by the government of Pakistan into fortified wheat flour. In addition, the WFP will purchase and distribute more than 9,000 tons of specialized food commodities to these groups. USAID's $20 million donation is a contribution to the Twinning Program, a partnership among the government of Pakistan, the WFP, and the international donor community. Through the Twinning Program, wheat donated by the government of Pakistan is milled into fortified wheat flour and distributed to vulnerable displaced populations in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Donor funds are used to cover the costs of milling, fortification, storage, transportation, and distribution of the flour. USAID is the largest international donor to the Twinning Program, and with this latest contribution has now reached $75 million in total support to the program since 2013. The U.S. government is helping Pakistan to improve access to safe and nutritious food for women, men, and children who are vulnerable to malnutrition, USAID Mission Director John Gruerk said. The United States has a long-standing commitment to working with Pakistan to provide humanitarian assistance and support human development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.